This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Couch Potatoes, across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week's new movies include Independence Day Resurgence, The Shallows, Free State of Jones, Dark Horse, and The Fitz. There's also going to be some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And of course, if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news is a sad one. Rest in peace to Anton Yelchin. This, of course, made news earlier this week. He died in the most literal car accident you could think of. Apparently, his car wasn't parked properly, and when he went to go check his mailbox at home, the car rolled and pinned him and crushed him, and he died. And he was only like 27 years old. And that's sad because he was a talent, and he was somebody who was actively doing movies. And the interesting thing with Anton Yelchin is he wasn't this sexy face man. He wasn't going to get those lead roles that Tom Cruise got in his younger days. He was a little bit different looking, but he was unique, and he sought out roles that were not in that mainstream, because part of it's, I think, because it's the only things that were available to him, but also it gave him a lot of diversity and found some really interesting stuff out there. I mean, even this year, he was in Green Room, which was a fantastic film. And if it were a big mainstream 3000 theater, 20th Century Fox release, it would not have starred him. And he was really making a name for himself in the smaller cinema, which was great. And it's nice to see a young actor doing that without bemoaning the fact that they're not, you know, on the top of the world and winning Academy Awards and becoming a $20 million box office draw. So yeah, it's sad to see Anton Yelchin go. I mean, I think one of his last movies is going to be the Star Trek sequel that comes out this summer, but there's going to be some more that are eking out. But it's always sad to see somebody go, especially when it's such a freak accident. It's not even like he was driving and was under the influence or was running a red light. He was just getting his mail. And so that's just sad on its own. So rest in peace, Anton Yelchin. A couple pieces of Lucasfilm news that are out. Indiana Jones 5, Spielberg has said that Lucas will be involved, which is cool because there's so much just knee-jerk hatred for Lucas, and people forget that he developed one of the greatest franchises ever, and even when he did the prequels to Star Wars, he did something different. He just didn't give you exactly what you had before, and you can complain about it, but he was a creative guy, and there's so much in modern cinema you wouldn't have without George Lucas. I was also fine with Indiana Jones 4. The whole alien storyline, I thought, was fine for what it was, being a movie in the 50s rather than a movie in the 30s or even the 40s. It wasn't a World War II movie. It was a Cold War movie. They're also going to start other Indiana Jones movies. Now, exactly how that's going to be, a reboot or whatever, who knows? But still, they're planning to continue those. Another piece of Lucasfilm news is Darth Vader has been confirmed that he is going to be in Rogue One. But, you know, my question is didn't we already know that? I mean, wasn't part of the buzz that his scenes are supposed to be really dark and gritty and compelling? Who knows? I mean, maybe they beefed these up in the reshoots. Maybe that was one of the things. They said, hey, Gareth Edwards, director who gave us Godzilla, let's not just have a bunch of shots of Darth Vader leaving rooms. Let's actually give him something to do. I really haven't read too much about this story because I tend to like to be surprised, and I like to experience a movie without knowing everything that's going to happen. And the way internet journalism is nowadays, it just wants to tell you everything that happens in a movie before you see it. See my later point for a different story coming up. So anyways, Darth Vader's in Rogue One. That's great. I love Darth Vader, and I think it might be adding something to the film, mainly because they got such mixed buzz with the story of reshoots and even that trailer caused some people to question a couple things. Now, the last piece of news I want to talk about is Warcraft this week became the highest grossing video game movie worldwide. And that's kind of cool for Duncan Jones that it wasn't, you know, it was a huge flop in America, but it wasn't overseas. But that's not as much of an accomplishment. And the reason for that is the marketplace has expanded considerably for the past 5 years. And so it's only really relevant to other movies that came around that time in this current environment. I mean, when Mortal Kombat came out in the 90s, or when the first Resident Evil came out in, what, the late 90s, you can't really do a one-to-one comparison with those, and those are arguably two of the more well-received video game movies out there. I want to know how the internet and the journalists on the internet are calling this a hit, while movies like John Carter, Battleship, Terminator, Genesis, and even Pacific Rim have been seen as mediocre or downright flops. And the reason is because internet journalism is becoming exactly what it was accused of being back during the death of print media, that it was becoming a fanboy standard. When you got a movie like Batman vs. Superman with almost 900 million worldwide, the fans who saw it and didn't like the movie, they latched so much onto the negative buzz that they drove the narrative and they created a truth. Yeah, it was a little bit of a disappointment because it wasn't $1.5 billion like the other Batman movies, but it's also not a bomb, which is why Zack Snyder is still on board to do Justice League. If it was to be believed as big of a bomb as the journalists on the internet wanted you to believe, Warner Brothers would have dumped Snyder from Justice League extremely fast. Now, in this situation, fanboys hate Zack Snyder far more than they hate Duncan Jones. In fact, they love Duncan Jones. Duncan Jones got a lot of goodwill for movies like Moon and Source Code, and so they're letting that color their perspective. But this is why the narrative plays this way. It's because of a deteriorating bad journalism rather than actual fact. They're proving to be lousy at journalism because they're essentially becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy and becoming exactly what they were accused of being 10, 15 years ago. Journalism should be journalism, whether it's a website or a blog or whether it's a print periodical. And this business of needing to create news just to stoke your fanboy rage or to fill digital pages with news that doesn't exist is shameful. It's a sad state of affairs. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Keeping Up with the Joneses, and it opens on October 21st.
Hey, Henny!
Still spying on the neighbors?
Hi.
We're the Joneses.
You don't think there's something off about them?
They're both so overly accomplished and stylish.
Welcome to the Cobra Club.
A little different than you expected, huh?
That looks like a real snake.
Snake one, that's real Cobra.
Do you have Tab?
The Joneses, they're not who they say they are.
Here's the thing about trust.
Once it's gone, bad things can happen.
Now, this one stars Zach Galifianakis and Ella Fisher and Gal Gadot and John Hamm. And it's we've seen these sort of things before, like Fun with Dick and Jane. And they even have like the Americans TV show where you've got the suburban couple that's sort of these spies and the average people kind of discover it or they run into it and they clash. And it's either tense drama like in the Americans or it's played up for goofy laughs as it is going to be in here. I mean, this is directed by the guy who did Superbad. This looks funny. And I like the people involved, except Gal Gadot. I think even in this trailer, there's not much in what I played, but you can just hear what a god-awful, terrible actress she is. And she's always going to be a god-awful, terrible actress until she gets some acting lessons, and then she might be just okay. But it still looks funny, because it's not all about her. The next one I want to talk about is A Street Cat Named Bob, which only opens in the UK so far. It doesn't have a US release date, but it opens on November 4th based on the best-selling book.
In the past, I've screwed up every opportunity I've been given.
I used to smile.
This time it's different. He's got a name. It's Bob.
You're keeping him, aren't you? I fell
in the river. So what number life are you on? Apparently I'm on my 9th.
You can't have an animal in your photo. This is your official ID.
I don't see an animal. This is my co-pilot.
Okay.
Okay, look, I'll take that off if you promise not to lick the stitches.
This looks cute and charming. It's, again, one of these stray pet stories that offers a certain amount of inspiration to people who are kind of down on their times. It just looks like a fun little movie and a cute little film. And, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm waiting for this one. Obviously, it's going to have to come to the U.S. And hopefully it gets a wide release. If not, I'm sure I'll catch it on home video. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Free State of Jones and Dark Horse. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, getting set to launch into our movie reviews. Let's hit the more down-to-earth films first, before we hit the big launching of Independence Day. And even The Shallows, which is realistic, I guess, but it's more of a broad thriller. Let's start with Free State of Jones. Matthew McConaughey stars as a Civil War deserter who tries to start his own sovereign state for free men in Mississippi in the late 1860s and 1870s.
I'm tired of it.
You, me, all of us. We're all out there dying so they can stay rich.
Tax collectors coming around here, taking everything. We have nothing for the winner.
They runaways?
Please, you.
And mom dies so they can get rich selling their cotton.
That's why we live, too.
No man ought to tell another man what he's got to live for. Oh, what he's got to die for.
Now, this is based on a true story. And as much as the Hollywood practice of slapping based on a true story or inspired by true events onto a movie annoys me at times, this is one that kind of gets a pass simply because it's not a well-known story. I'm not an aficionado of the Civil War. I'm not an expert on the Civil War. I'm not an expert on the Confederacy. But I've also never heard of this. There's things that I'm not an expert on that I'm at least somewhat familiar with. I've never heard of this whole little situation that happened in Mississippi at this time, but it's a fascinating story. Now, it's directed by Gary Ross, who did one of the Hunger Games movies, and it tackles a lot of stuff. It's a great piece for acting, as you would expect. These are always kind of award bait movies, which is kind of odd that it's coming out at the end of June. Usually you'd expect this thing to wait until October to drop. But I think STX, which is the studio that's handling this, wants to avoid any sort of competition with Birth of a Nation. And this does feel a bit this year like it's the, hey, well, you know, 12 Years a Slave came out a couple years ago, and that's when it won the Academy Award. And we're ready to get back onto white guilt again, so let's champion these movies. But the fact that this comes out in the summer actually makes it just feel like an authentic movie and not trying to win awards, which is kind of good. It's a conversation piece more than anything else for me. It tackles a lot of issues that go far beyond just this one guy deserting during the Civil War. And in that sense, it gives you a relatively full account of the story, but at the same time, there's a real problem with the focus. You don't know whose story it is. Is it really Matthew McConaughey's character, which is Newton Knight, whether it's his story or whether it's the escaped slaves that were there, whether it was their story, or even at one point it's like flashes forward into the 50s where one of Knight's ancestors is fighting a trial for segregation himself, and whether it's that person's story. So it just throws so much at you that's, I guess, relevant to the story, but it really feels like it could have been like a mini series on television more than it could have been just this one movie. It feels like they really just crammed almost too much in, but they do a decent job keeping it even. You don't feel like the movie unravels or completely goes out of focus at any point. I mean, it does gloss over certain elements to it. Like the escaped slaves in this little group don't kind of get their just due until way later than they should. And it glosses over other elements, like Second Amendment elements that you can really take away a lot from this movie on many different issues out there and many different issues that different sides of the political spectrum are going to disagree on on either side. You know, like, it has Second Amendment issues going on in the movie that you can glean from this film. It's got gay marriage issues. Even though it doesn't deal with gay marriage, it deals with interracial stuff, which is oftentimes a lot of people will compare the two in terms of fighting for the civil rights. So you can apply some of this to gay marriage. You can apply some of this to constitutionality. You can apply some of this to voting. You can, and like, there's a whole thing about post-Civil War trying to get the blacks the right to vote. But there's no comment whatsoever on the women because the women weren't given the vote until later. So, I mean, this is a real interesting film that works. And in a way, it kind of feels a bit like two parts, like Gone with the Wind, where Gone with the Wind had the lead up to the Civil War, and the second half was Reconstruction and what happened then when the carpetbaggers come. And even though it's not as big of a slice down the middle the way, I mean, like, that's where the intermission was in Gone with the Wind. But this one does have two separate parts, and one part is much more concerned with civil rights, and the first one is more concerned with just autonomy and freedom of the free man, and not wanting to fight a war for the wealthy, which was a set. And then this can be applied to the Occupy Wall Street crowd and the 99 percenters for the reason that this guy originally left the Confederate Army. So overall, while it's a little bit messy, Free State of Jones is a good movie. It's definitely worth seeing and definitely worth some discussion. I'm going to say that it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Dark Horse. In a small town in Wales, a group of pubgoers band together to breed their own racehorse, who has a surprising career.
We were a tight-knit community, as most mining communities are.
It was a Thursday. Jan was working. She said, I'm going to breed a racehorse. We put a sign up on the wall. Anybody wants to join a syndicate of racehorse ownership, speak to Jan. He was a working class horse that was about to take on the likes of the best.
He was now mixing with the big time.
40 horses and you got eyes for one.
Even though I know people who handle horses, my cousin actually went to school to study horses and worked with show horses. I couldn't care less. I'm not a horse guy. I mean, I think they're beautiful animals, and I've ridden horses before, I've interacted with horses before, but I'm not a horse guy. You know, there are dog people and there are cat people. Well, there are horse people out there as well. And when I first heard about this, and I knew I was going to be seeing it, I was kind of like, oh, it's going to be a horse movie. You know, it's going to feel like Flicka, only a documentary with the Welsh in it. So I had zero interest in this film. I have zero interest in horses. I have zero interest in horse racing. Yeah, I live about 4 hours north of Louisville, which is where the Kentucky Derby takes place. And I've been down in Louisville and Lexington area during Kentucky Derby time. And yeah, the entire city feels like a 12-year-old girl's bedroom because of all the horse stuff going on there. But I'm not into that. But I'll tell you, you don't have to be to love this movie. This movie is one of the most charming documentaries I've seen in a long time. It's got a cast of just interesting and bizarre characters, all these different Welsh pub goers who are basically just average citizens, some of them actually lower economic levels. And what they do is, because it's so expensive to raise a horse, they just band together like 30 of them and they throw in like 10 pounds a week or something like that. And they found a horse and they bred a horse and they start entering it into events. And the horse has a certain amount of talent, and even though no one believed in them at the beginning, but it's this weird little engine that could type story with the underdog, and it's a great story, and you see these people's passion for the horse, and you see these people's love for their horse, and it means so much more than just somebody who raises horses, and it's one of a dozen in their stables. This is the one that these people had. And you really want to just go to the pub, have a couple pints with them, and you end up owning part of the horse at that point. But it's a charming little movie, and it's really neat, and it's one that's quite literally for the title. It's a dark horse that nobody is thinking about, but it's definitely something that you got to see if you can find it. You know, get past the fact it's a documentary, people, because I know those bore some folks, but this one is a neat little movie. Check it out. Dark Horse rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Independence Day, Resurgence, and The Shallows. The there's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue with the movie reviews. Let's talk about what should have been one of the biggest movies of the summer, and that is Independence Day Resurgence. It's been 20 years since we've defeated the invading aliens, and now they've returned to attack our new line of defense developed from their own technology.
Oh my God. A distress call.
Why are they screaming?
They're not screaming. They're celebrating.
They're coming back.
Shouldn't we be nervous?
Yeah.
Our whole lives built up to this moment.
It's touchdown over the Atlantic.
Which part?
All of it.
Make them pay.
Not going up there to make friends.
We've got to remind them Earth is not for the taking.
Just on a personal level, I found it very odd, my experience of seeing Independence Day. It was not screened for press. As I understand, it wasn't screened for press anywhere in the U.S., or at least very, very, very limited in the U.S., which is usually a bad sign. And not that a big movie can't have bad reviews. There are plenty of films that have terrible reviews that do extremely well. But what happened in this case, I think a lot of times when they hold these film reviews, it's like they don't want certain pieces of information to get out, not just that it's got a bad review. For example, this film, the biggest problem this movie has over the original is you don't care about any of the cast. I mean, yeah, you got Jeff Goldblum and Bill Pullman coming back. You even have a neat little cameo by Robert Loggia and his wife, and she's actually thrilled to be in the movie because he, of course, died in December. So you have a lot of throwbacks to the original film, but, you know, Jeff Goldblum's not a draw anymore. I mean, back then he was coming off of Jurassic Park. I mean, he was a huge star. And Will Smith was just getting his feet wet in the blockbuster world, but came off a lot of good buzz from Bad Boys and from the smaller film, Six Degrees of Separation. In this film, you've got, like, Liam Hemsworth. And I don't understand why this guy is still getting roles. There is no draw whatsoever for Liam Hemsworth. He's just boring. It's like having a piece of white bread, but with some butter on it, running your movie. It's just, he's boring. There's no it factor that like Will Smith had. Even the guy who played Will Smith's kid in this is equally as boring as Liam Hemsworth. And of course, you had Mae Whitman playing the president's daughter, Bill Pullman's daughter in the original. They don't have her. They brought in Micah Monroe. And she's really boring it as well. I mean, I like Micah Monroe. I think she's great in movies like It Follows and The Guest and some of these more independent fringe movies. But when it comes to putting her in a blockbuster, she just loses all steam. It's sort of like Parker Posey in the 90s. And that's, I think, the biggest problem with this film is that there's no star power to it. Anybody who's recognizable, name-wise, is the old cast. And I think it's stuff like that that the studio wants to hide. They'd be like, oh, well, we don't want people to realize that there's nobody of any interest in this movie. And if they're told that by critics, they'll know. And there's nothing to it. The other thing is the original Independence Day, it was a game changer. And a lot of people throw around the term game changer, but it was a game changer. And every now and then you get a movie that's a game changer, something like Jaws or Star Wars or Iron Man or the Harry Potter films or the Lord of the Rings movies. These are films that change the way movies are made. And before Independence Day came out in 1996, you never saw this scope and scale of alien destruction. Yeah, you had War of the Worlds, but this was War of the Worlds for the 90s. And I remember it was the big thing. And I remember seeing a preview, like an extended preview at a sci-fi festival months before it came out. And people were excited as all get out to go see this movie. And it was only a couple weeks ago that I'm like, hey, wait, isn't there an Independence Day movie coming out soon? This is just lost in the shuffle. And you see this movie and all the scope, all the big stuff, all the alien scenes, all the attacks, all the ships, all the technology, all the battles, you've seen it before. Not only have you seen it before, but you've seen it a couple times this year with movies like Batman vs. Superman and Captain America Civil War. It's nothing new. And that's kind of part of the problem with this movie, is you feel like it's just going through the motions again and you're getting a retread of Independence Day. Now, what's funny is I saw it almost to the day, 20 years later, in the same theater. I don't think I wasn't in the same house, but I was down the hall from it in the exact same theater. So that was a little bit of nostalgia on my part, but this movie doesn't even live off nostalgia. Jurassic World lived off nostalgia. Finding Dory got propelled by nostalgia. This one, there's no nostalgia to this. And there's nothing wrong with the original Independence Day. It's just this one. You know, this feels like it was a TV movie that was made as a sequel, just with all the special effects and the big budget that you would normally have. That's sort of the level of writing. The writing isn't very good. The characters are stupid. And not that the characters and writing were great in the first movie, but they certainly worked for the big budget popcorn movie. This one, they're stupid. They make decisions where you're just like, why are you doing that? That's just dumb. And like you said, how do the aliens sneak up on people in space? It's space. There's nothing to hide behind. This movie is, it's kind of dumb. I mean, I liked certain parts of to it, but you just never felt like it was, you were part of the film. You always felt like you were just watching a rehash of the first Independence Day with some better, slightly better special effects. So ultimately, I'm going to have to say, while there's a certain entertainment quality to it, it's not worth full price. I'm going to say Independence Day Resurgence, sadly, kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Shallows. A woman is stranded when a massive shark stalks her near a beach where she is surfing.
Hey, sis.
Hey.
I just want to let you know I made it here. Mom was right. It took forever to find, but it's perfect.
What did you say the name of this place was?
This is paradise.
No! Shark!
It is impossible to talk about any movie that involves a shark as a main character without comparing it to Jaws. It just is impossible. I mean, now I talked about Jaws being a game changer. It changed the game for everything, from monster movies to blockbusters to scary films, and it was the benchmark for scary shark movie. And even when they do movies like Deep Blue Sea, which is very different from Jaws, you still have to compare it to Jaws. This movie actually feels a little more like Open Water. I don't know if people remember that one. That came about, that was 10 or 12 years ago, and that was about these divers who were left, the boat left, and they didn't count the tanks properly, and they were just sort of left out there, and there are these sharks that were circling the waters and coming after them, and nobody knows what happened to these people. Now, Open Water, I thought, was a fantastic movie, but this feels a lot like it. Now, there's parts of this that are really well done. I mean, the shark looks great. The shark really, really looks good in this movie. It authentically feels and looks like a great white shark is attacking Blake Lively out there. And the moments where the shark is there is pretty awesome. And some of the suspense things work as well. There are some problems with it, though. One of them is, it's even though it's only like an hour and 27 minutes, there's not a whole lot of story there. It's a woman goes to a beach and she has a little bit of backstory, but then she gets attacked by a shark and has to survive. Not much story. So it does drag a bit, and we get into these moments of being stranded. If you remember the movie In the Heart of the Sea with Chris Hemsworth, another Hemsworth who doesn't do well outside of the superhero movies, where he was playing the inspiration for Moby Dick, that one was an interesting movie when the whale was coming after him, but when they were stranded on an island or just stranded in the ocean, it was just kind of boring. People sitting on something floating in the ocean for extended periods of time doesn't really get me going for a movie. And that's the problem with this film. It just gets boring at times. Now, the other thing is there are some scenes that could be really grisly and terrifying, but they obviously cut away and pull their punches in order to maintain a PG-13 rating. And I understand why they do that. It's PG-13. It's studios. That's how it happens. But it feels cheap. So this is not nearly as good as Jaws. And there are times where I watch it and I go, you know, they could have made some choices to make this even really terrifying. But it just works sort of for the thrill and spectacle. It's a passable movie. It's perfectly adequate. So ultimately, I'm going to say The Shallows kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to finish up reviews with The Fitz, talk about the box office and the home cinema roundup. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing on with the movie reviews, finishing them up with The Fitz. It's a much smaller film. You know, I did the big ones. I did Independence Day for you. And let's talk about a smaller one that might get a little bit of attention. And The Fitz is about a young tomboy who takes a break from her boxing practice to join a dance team, only to be in danger from an epidemic of seizures in the group. This is very much an independent film. This is very much a non-mainstream movie. It's a much slower, deliberately paced film, limited sets, limited cast, and it is more about the performance and the undertones behind the movie than about the overt story. Because like I said in the description, there's not a whole lot to that story. It's just this girl, she's a very in shape, like 11-year-old. She's still tiny. She hasn't quite gone through puberty yet. She's really, really fit. And she works in this boxing gym with her brother she helps him out. But she gets sort of interested in doing the dance troupe, this sort of drill team that is also in the gym. And it's 180 degrees out of phase with what she normally is. She's the tomboy, but of course it's the dance troupe that does. It's not like sexy dancing, but they do have the dance moves. They have, I don't even know the term for it, you know, the moving around much more provocatively than you would in a boxing ring, we'll say. And of course, the other girls in the troupe, they're more developed. The older girls are more developed. They're talking about boys and they're talking about puberty things. They're talking about things that little girls no longer talk about. And in a way, this is sort of, I took this as a bit of an analogy of her going through puberty, about her growing up and the fits, which is these girls are just having these seizures and they're going to the hospital and they don't know what it's from. They don't know if it's something environmental. They don't know if it's something in the water at the school or the water in the community, or if it's like a disease that's being passed on. They don't know what's happening here. And of course, everybody's in danger of having the fits, but the fits is more of, there's a lot of symbolism, and I don't know, I could be reading too much into it, but I kind of took the dance troupe as her being interested in no longer tomboy things, going through a little bit through puberty, getting interested in boys, getting interested in makeup, getting interested in nicer clothes, and the fits is ultimately giving into that. Who knows? I don't know. I wouldn't call myself a great expert at breaking down films, but this definitely feels like it's a movie on top of something else it's trying to say. Well done, well shot. It does run a little long for how short it is, because it's a very simple story, but it's meant to be one of those fly on the wall type of movies. And in that sense, it works. So it's a different piece of alternative cinema. I guess kind of worth seeing. So I'm going to have to say The Fitz kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. And was I correct last week? I said that Finding Dory was going to make $110 million. It made way more than that. It actually broke box office records. And that's significant because Finding Dory was a sequel that came, 12 years later? It made $135 million in its opening weekend, dwarfing Central Intelligence that made over $35 million. And that's nothing to sneeze at either. Central Intelligence cost $50 million to make. And maybe if they blew their budget on P&A and advertising, you know, you're maybe talking $80 to $100 million total for the entire price tag of this film. And it's going to make that back. Central Intelligence is going to be a nice little walkaway hit for Warner Brothers that nobody's going to talk about because it just got dwarfed by Finding Dory. But Central Intelligence did extremely well as well. And Finding Dory, this was the first weekend in a while where it was bona fide, huge numbers for movies. And this is also, interestingly enough, one of the few sequels this summer that not only has exceeded the expectations for the weekend, but it far exceeded the opening numbers of the original. Now, I don't know whether Finding Dory is going to end up at the very end domestically being as big of a hit as Finding Nemo, because that had long, long legs. But it's definitely going to be worldwide because, as I said earlier in the show, you know, the markets opened up and the international markets opened up. Now, one of the things that drove Finding Dory to its success was the fact that they waited 12 years, which normally is a bad thing for a movie, but this worked a lot on nostalgia. You had all these people who are 20 years old going to see this because they watched the original Finding Nemo on DVD when they were like 6, 7, 8 years old. And that is what drives this movie to the heights that it's at. I'll give you an example. I knew people who were teenagers who were going to see the movies, and they were going to see Finding Dory. No shame whatsoever in going to see a kid's animated movie. The kids wanted to see it. And so it wasn't like, oh, well, I guess I'll see it. I kind of want to see it, but I'll have to take my brother because he'll only go see a Disney movie. I can't go see a Disney movie alone. But no, this worked on that nostalgia. So Finding Dory was a huge monster hit. And it will likely win the weekend again this week. 75, 85 million. I mean, it's not going to drop that much because the competition isn't all that stiff. I mean, it's a four quadrant film. But here's the thing with Independence Day. Independence Day, and I mentioned this in the review, Independence Day, its time has kind of passed. And while Finding Dory did well 12 years later, we're talking 20 years later for Independence Day. We're in the lines of the Psycho sequel, when they did Psycho 2 back in the 80s. It was over 20 years after the original Psycho came out. This is the 20th anniversary of the first Independence Day movie, and the buzz just isn't there. There have been a lot of these kind of movies since then, whereas that was unique and different. And the blowing up the White House in the first movie, was, you didn't see that sort of thing. And it was a movie with huge scope. It was the Lawrence of Arabia of alien invasion films. And now it's just another big effects extravaganza. So yeah, I think it's still going to do fine, but it's going to have about the opening that the original one, which was like $50 million, and 20 years ago, $50 million was great. Now $50 million will get you a seat on the Warcraft disappointment table. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. First movie I want to talk about is My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, which was surprisingly better than I thought it would be. It's actually quite charming. Which is odd, because pretty much everything else that Nia Vardalos touches just completely withers away and dies. My Life in Ruins flopped in the U.S., but it did okay overseas. Those are like consolation prizes. You can't call something a bona fide hit if you're like, well, it did well overseas. That's the David Hasselhoff of movies, if you're using that excuse. But still, My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 was charming, mainly because it brings back everybody from the first film, and it's not just about her. She's actually really secondary in the film. She's not all that great in the movie. It's everybody else that works. It was just that cast that clicked, and it still clicks now, 15 years later. The next one I want to talk about is Midnight Special, which is a real interesting movie, directed by the guy who did Mud and Take Shelter. Michael Shannon's in it, and he does a really good job acting. Joel Edgerton's in it, and he does a great job acting. It's a little bit of a low-key movie. And this guy, Jeff Nichols, he finds his drama among the characters interpersonal angst. You know, he could be in the middle of a galactic war like Independence Day, and it would all just be about a bunch of people arguing, and that's where he finds his movies. I'm not into that sort of thing. So while the Midnight Special looked really cool and had some neat ideas, it was not fully explored with what it could do. And in that sense, it comes across like a bit of a cheap sci-fi movie by somebody who doesn't know how to make a sci-fi movie. And that's fine, because that's not what he was trying to do, but it felt like it was stealing the sci-fi brand a little bit more than it should have. Then there's The Brothers Grimsby, which I actually liked. Thank you very much. I know there's a lot of people who didn't. And this movie flopped, and flopped hard. But I thought it was a lot of fun. It's stupid. It's one of the dumbest movies that was released this year. But I thought it was funny. I mean, it's like the Ace Ventura When Nature Calls of spy movies. There's also The Wave, which is about a Norwegian tsunami type thing that comes through a fjord and the destruction that wreaks. It's a big movie that I think could actually, it's one of those few that I think could do well with an American remake because of the disaster potential. Hey, Roland Emmerich, you know, off the heels of Independence Day too, you can go check out maybe a remake of The Wave. There's also Embrace the Serpent. It's a foreign language film about a guy going into the rainforest. And it's an interesting movie shot in black and white. And then finally, The Hollow Crown, The War of the Roses, the BBC film series on TV about the different Shakespeare plays that take place within The War of the Roses. For all of you history buffs out there, like my father. But it has Benedict Cumberbatch in it. That makes it British. That's it for this week. I need to get ready and prepare for Independence Day next week, when I'll be talking about the BFG, The Legend of Tarzan, and The Purge Election Day. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.